Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. So fantastic to have everybody here. Thank you, everybody, including my wife, who brought treats. It's what makes Paradox a special class, yes. And thank you for bringing semi-healthy treats. Always seemed odd to me in our Protestant tradition. We go to these conferences where there's these fantastic sermon or great teaching about apologetics, and we go out and we get the food, and the food is like Jell-O and Kool-Aid and, you know, Twinkies, and it's pretty pathetic. We need to learn from the Seventh-day Adventists, who take the admonitions in the Bible to take care of ourselves seriously. let's see. Really good news for this. You're never going to hear these words ever again in Paradox class. You ready for this? Hugh's going to be with us for the next 11 weeks, including June 16th, when he's going to be preaching both services in at Christ Church, and then the week after, June 25th, he's going to do a series, a five-week series here as part of Paradox class, which will sort of reintroduce the church to him and his ministry, and it's going to be sort of a whirlwind tour of everything Reasons to Believe teaches. Is that fair enough? Focused on Genesis. So that's going to be good. 5 weeks starting, what did I say, June 23rd. Yes. Okay. Let's see. Thank you always to Tim and Mark and Jamie for doing the tech, for turning the knobs, for understanding that equipment. Mark gets here like an hour early. If you feel like it, you should shake their hand and say thank you for making this class work, because it's amazing. And thank you to Dave. He's got the book table over there. If you want any of Hugh's books, if there's a book that you want of Hugh's that's not there, ask Dave and I'm sure he can get it. So I think there's no other special announcements. Let's say a prayer. We'll get to Dr. Hugh Ross. Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you, thank you for this class, for what it's meant to so many of us for so many years. Personally, I can't imagine what my life would have been as a follower of you, Lord, without this class. Dr. Ross and this class really brought my faith to life. Thank you for the beautiful day, our beautiful California day. Thank you, Lord, for Dr. Ross and his teaching. Please bless him as he teaches us and each one of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you so much. In Jesus' very precious name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, last weekend I was in St. Louis speaking at Grace Church, and they recorded all of my messages, and you can go online and watch or listen to all of them. Matter of fact, I go there about once a year, and they have archived all the different messages I have given there. What I like about that church, too, is that after every sermon, there's an open mic Q&A. And by the way, when I do the sermons at this church on June 16th, they've given me permission to do a Q&A after each message. So feel free to bring your friends and literally ask any question you would like, kind of like we do here in the Paradoxes class. So, the series that we're going to be launching on June 23rd, I'm going to be taking you through the first 11 chapters of the Bible, Genesis 1 to 11. And it's not going to be a commentary on those first 11 chapters. What we're going to do is hit all the controversial points in those 11 chapters that cause unbelievers to question the Bible, to question whether or not there really is a God. So I'm basically wanting to take you through those chapters to equip you to deal with the objections that you run into, not just from unbelievers, but from believers as well, for really taking the entire Bible as the inspired and inerrant Word of God. And it's actually something you'll see in the book that we're kind of going through, Rescuing Inerrancy. It's those first 11 chapters of the Bible that really caused theologians, not just liberal theologians, but conservative theologians, to question whether you can really trust the entire Bible as the inspired, inerrant Word of God. Now, what I'm going to be doing this Sunday is basically getting at the core of what's caused people to question biblical inerrancy, the idea that the Bible is error-free on everything that it touches, not just faith, practice, but also dealing with geography, history, and science. And this challenge began when Charles Darwin published his book, Origin of Species, and it got exacerbated when he came out with his second book, Descent of Man, where he was basically challenging the biblical doctrine that we human beings were specially created by God and endowed with the image of God. He's saying, no, we evolved like all life from microbes that appeared naturalistically on the face of the earth, and through common descent, we evolved and we came here. And therefore, we're really not that different from the animals, and really not that different from that matter, from the microbes from whom we all evolved. And after Descent of Man was published, there was a famous American atheist that went around the country speaking, basically giving the triumph of Darwin over Christianity. His name was Robert Greene Ingersoll. And in 1884, he gave a famous speech that has now been published in a book. And what he said in this speech is one of the highlights of the speech that he gave. And the speech was called Orthodoxy. And he was basically challenging that Christianity is an orthodox faith. He says it's not an orthodox faith. The only orthodox faith we have is from Charles Darwin. And this is what he wrote, or what got penned from his speech in Orthodoxy. He said, quote, "Darwin has removed in every thinking mind the last vestige of Orthodox Christianity. He has not only stated, but has demonstrated that the inspired writer knew nothing of geology, nothing of astronomy, nothing of nature, that the Bible is a book written by ignorance," meaning that there's nothing in the Bible you can really trust to be true. Now, what has happened in the 21st century is you've got modern-day theologians, liberal and conservative, that actually believe that what Robert Ingersoll said was true. And by the way, in the 1890s, he kept predicting that there would be the death of Christianity, that within a century, there wouldn't be any Christians because of the march and advance of science would prove that Christianity was simply a religion of ignorance, that it would disappear and go away. But in the 1890s, there were revivals breaking out throughout all of North America. And there were Christians who came up to Robert Ingersoll and said, "You predicted the death of Christianity, but every day we're planting a new church here in America, and not just in America, but around the world." And we've now gone more than a century since that speech in 1884, and the Christianity as a faith, as a religion, has been growing. Now, there is some news that the church is shrinking here in America. Pew surveys demonstrate that. Barna surveys show that church attendance is shrinking, although I think a lot of that could be blamed on COVID. I mean, to this day, what I discover as I go around and speak in churches is how many people participate virtually. So if you add the virtual audience to the in-person audience, the church really hasn't shrunk that much, if at all. And especially if you add the number of people that don't participate through live streaming, but they participate through the downloaded message. And when we live in a day of modern technology where you could actually, 3 weeks later, go on the internet and download the message and get it, that's true here of the Paradoxes class. I mean, there's not many of you that are here in person. There's more of you that participate online, but our biggest audience of all is people who download the messages. And I remember there's a couple of messages that I gave here that have been downloaded 60,000 times. So look at us, multiply it up. I don't think the church is shrinking. Not even here in America is it shrinking. Although I do notice the church is growing much more rapidly outside of North America and Europe than inside of North America and Europe. Christianity is no longer a white man's religion. It's no longer a Western religion. the predominant Christian population is outside the West and outside of America. And I've been to these places, and it's just remarkable how rapidly the church is growing overseas. And so Ingersoll's boasts that Christianity would disappear, it's not disappearing, it's growing more and more. But Robert Ingersoll is not alone. Since the 1880s, there have been numerous scientists who have gone public and saying that the Bible is full of scientific nonsense. Probably the most famous one we know today would be a fellow who wrote The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins in Britain. Although it's interesting about Richard Dawkins, he wrote a scathing book, The God Delusion, which he basically was claiming the Bible and Christianity is full of scientific nonsense, and basically was backing up what Robert Ingersoll said. We can explain everything without a God with respect to life, how life originated and how it evolved into us human beings. There is no need for a God. The Bible got it all wrong. And I think last week I introduced you to Jerry Coyne, and he's an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. And in a book that he wrote just a few years ago in 2015, he basically repeated what Robert Ingersoll had declared. He says, the greatest scripture killer ever penned, a reference to Charles Darwin's two books, demolished an entire series of biblical claims by demonstrating that purely naturalistic processes, evolution and natural selection, could explain patterns in nature. And I've written in Rescuing Inerrancy, the problem is we got 21st century theologians who believe that indeed this is correct. And therefore they're saying we have to reinterpret the Bible and acknowledge the fact that the history of life can be explained through naturalistic mechanisms alone, including our own existence. We're not the product of God especially creating a woman and a man, tens of thousands of years ago from which we're all descended. No, we actually come from a common ancestor through natural descent, strictly natural descent, a common ancestor that we hold with the chimpanzees, the Neanderthals, and Homo erectus. Now, I think last week I told you the story of my debate with Jerry Coyne. Can you confirm that? Because if I haven't, I'll repeat it. No, I did say that, right? Okay, so I won't repeat the story. You can get it in a recording. But yeah, I had a very entertaining debate with Jerry Coyne in front of a bunch of trial lawyers. But what I find interesting as I engage evolutionary biologists is how they walk away from the origin of life. They make these bold statements. We can explain the entire history of life. Well, what about the origin of life? Like nearly all evolutionary biologists who are naturalists, Coyne avoids addressing the multiple intractable problems and naturalistic scenarios for the origin of life. And the problem with that is that's a way easier thing to explain and investigate than the history of life. Because in the origin of life, you're basically making a claim, well-understood physics and chemistry can explain where biology come from. So now we're dealing with much simpler scientific endeavors. And so if you're going to argue for naturalism, you would think you would want to start with the origin of life. That'd be the easiest place to prove a naturalistic worldview. But I can tell you for the past 40 years when I've debated evolutionary biologists, when I bring up the origin of life, they say, look, I'm going to give you a pass on that one. Let's talk about the rest of the stuff. They really don't want to talk about the origin of life. And everyone I've engaged admits that they don't have a scenario for the origin of life that works. Now, what I want to do briefly, we've written a whole book on this, Origins of Life, a book that Faisal Rana, our staff biochemist, and I collaborated to write. And we actually have 200 articles up on our website that we've now linked to the second edition of the book, basically making the point, the more we learn about the origin of life, the more impossible it becomes to defend a naturalistic interpretation. But what I want to do for you briefly is to give you some tools where you don't have to be a biochemist that you can use when you run into people who make the claim, hey, we indeed do have a naturalistic origin of life. And one book I would recommend would be a book called The Fifth Miracle. It's written by an agnostic physicist, Paul Davies. And late in his life, he said, I've been hearing all these stories, how we've got the origin of life all figured out. And so I began to read the literature to see if this is really the case and discovered it wasn't at all. And so he purposely titled the book The Fifth Miracle, basically saying we've all been told a story about the origin of life. And that's the problem I'm running into with these theologians. They've been convinced that these evolutionary biologists really do have an answer for the origin of life. And we've been engaging the scientists and theologians of the theistic evolutionary organization BioLogos, though they prefer to call themselves evolutionary creationists. And I remember the first meeting, we said, well, let's see if we can find some common ground, some things that we both organizations believe on, both reasons to believe in BioLogos. So I brought up the origin of life, thinking surely they're going to agree with us that that's not a naturalistic event, it's God supernaturally intervening. And they said, no, we're not prepared to go there. You may be right about this, but that's not something we're prepared. We think there is a possibility that these people will come up with a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life. And so we were rather surprised that that's actually an area where we differ. Okay, let me just jump into this. Naturalistic life origin problems. I'm going to deal with six items, and these are not by any means exhaustive. There are many more than these, but these are six I've chosen for you today that I think are relatively easy to understand without getting into a lot of scientific technicalities. One of the things we notice about the origin of life is that it occurs geologically immediately. It occurs as soon as conditions would permit the origin of life. Because when I took a course from Carl Sagan at the University of Toronto, he actually spent a talk on the origin of life, where he said, here's the model for how life arose. There's this vast soup of prebiotic molecules, and it percolated for at least a billion years. And then by random chemical interactions, we wind up with a simple microbe. Well, we know that it isn't a billion years. We now have isotope tools. And you say, what are isotope tools? Well, look at the carbon atom. With carbon, you've got carbon with 13 nucleons, 12 nucleons, and 14 nucleons. We call them carbon-12, carbon-13, and carbon-14. They all have six protons, but you have six, seven, or eight neutrons. But one of the things we notice about living organisms, they don't like the heavy isotopes. They like the light isotope. And so one way we can determine whether we're scientifically investigating an organism, do they have a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13? And now those are two stable isotopes. They're not radioactive. And so what we notice is all living organisms have a higher amount of carbon-12 compared to carbon-13 than stuff that's not living. And so it's one of the ways we can detect life. So even though we don't have the fossils of Earth's first life, although I've argued we will find them on the moon, we'll never find them on the Earth because Earth's geology has destroyed them, we do have the isotope signature. And so we see these ancient rocks that we've been investigating, apatite inclusions actually, where we do see a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13, a higher ratio of nitrogen-14 to nitrogen-15, and a higher ratio of sulfur-32 to sulfur-34. That's the way life is. Life always favors the lighter isotope. There's less energy involved and when you go with the lighter isotopes. And so these three different isotope ratios tell us that life has not only been present on the Earth, it's been abundant on the Earth back to 3.825 billion years ago. And say, how accurately do we know that? It's 3.825 plus or minus 0.006 billion. So it's a rather accurate date we have. Now, there is some hints that maybe there was life even before that, but it's short-lived and it's not abundant. the first time we see evidence for pervasive, abundant, diverse life is 3.825 billion years ago. Now, there's some evidence that in parts of the Canadian Shield, we actually see that there may have been life that briefly appeared. And that's because when you look, say, from 4.1 billion years ago to 3.8 billion years ago, there are very brief episodes where instead of the planet being hellishly hot, you actually got liquid water and rocks. But they're not stable. The water, again, turns back into steam, and the rocks go to a molten state. The first time that you actually have rocks that are permanently in a rock state, and where you got water that remains liquid permanently, is 3.83 billion years ago. So that's the first time that you got an opportunity for diverse, abundant microbes. And it's possible there might have been brief episodes earlier, but very brief. What we notice is that 3.83, it's really close to 3.825. So how much time do you have for the origin of life? Less than 50 million years. So just 0.05 billion. You don't have a billion years. And it could be a whole lot less than those 50 million. But we, and the error bar is about that. So from a geological perspective, we know the origin of life was virtually instantaneous. And moreover, it's not just one microbe that comes up. We see an entire ecology of microbes. Okay. Number two, when Carl Sagan talked about this vast prebiotic soup, we now know there was no prebiotic soup. And so here's the thing. How can you have a naturalistic model for the origin of life if you got no time and no soup? If there's no soup, you got nothing to work with. Now, how do we know that there is no soup? Well, we look at these carbonaceous molecules, and what we notice is that previous to 3.825 billion years, what we notice is we don't see any prebiotics. We only see postbiotics. And so there are no carbonaceous molecules that we can relate to the origin of life that predates 3.825. And afterwards, we notice we don't see any prebiotics. We only see postbiotics. We only see the remains of living organisms. We don't see the carbonaceous molecules that have the isotope signatures at telling us they were from non-living material. It doesn't exist. And so that tells us planet Earth never had a prebiotic soup. Now, the third thing is we know why Earth never had a prebiotic soup. It's called the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. Namely, that if you have oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, that oxygen stops the prebiotic chemistry. You can't have prebiotic chemistry. Oxygen is highly corrosive, and it's basically going to prevent prebiotic chemistry from happening. And you say, well, what if the Earth didn't have any oxygen at all? Well, if it didn't have any oxygen at all, there would be no ozone to stop ultraviolet radiation coming in from the sun, including the short wavelength ultraviolet radiation. And that short wavelength ultraviolet radiation brings to a halt prebiotic chemistry. So you've got a lose-lose proposition. If you have oxygen, it can't happen. If you don't have oxygen, it can't happen, which means you can't have a naturalistic origin of life on planet Earth. That explains the sudden interest in astrobiology, where you have these naturalists saying, well, the ultraviolet oxygen paradox proves it can't happen on Earth. Maybe it happened somewhere else and got transported here. So maybe life originated on Mars and a meteorite brought that life to planet Earth. But Mars also suffers from an oxygen ultraviolet paradox. In fact, that's a problem with any rocky body in the solar system. Well, number four in the list is the homochirality requirement. That in order to explain how amino acids come together to make proteins, the amino acids all have to be left-handed. It's kind of like Lego blocks, is that you have to put the Lego blocks together in a certain way. And if you have a left-handed amino acid and a right-handed, you say, what do you mean by that? Basically, it's a configuration of the molecule where in some cases the hydrogen atom is on the right side, other cases on the left side. But if you want to link them together to make a protein, they all have to be left-handed or they all have to be right-handed. And the same thing's true of DNA and RNA, is that the nucleosides are linked together by sugars, and rather complex sugars. They're linked together by ribose, which is a 5-carbon sugar, but ribose likewise comes in two configurations, one that's left-handed and one that's right-handed. And if you want to join together the nucleosides to make DNA and RNA chains, it's crucial that all the ribose sugars either be left-handed or all of them must be right-handed. Now here's the problem. In the natural world, outside of organisms, we notice the amino acids are a random mixture of left and right-handed amino acids. You know, 50-50 if you got a large enough sample. And same thing's true of the ribose sugars, is that it's about a 50-50 ratio. The other thing we notice is that outside of living systems, we can't find all the 20 bioactive amino acids. Now, they have discovered 11 of them outside of living systems. They're the 11 simplest ones. The 9 complex ones have never been found outside of living systems. So tryptophan, that amino acid that makes you go to sleep after you've had a big turkey dinner, that's one of the more complex amino acids. You find it in turkey, you find it in the human body, but you will not find it in non-living systems. And so they've only found 11. And by the way, of those 11, 5 are rare, really rare. Only 6 are relatively common. And glycine, the simplest of the amino acids, accounts for 90% of the amino acids that have been discovered. And so the more complex amino acid, the less likely you are to find it in a non-living system, and 9 of them can't be found at all. Same thing with ribose. Ribose has been found in non-living systems, but we're talking at less than a part per billion. So it's incredibly rare to find ribose, and only recently have astronomers found ribose outside of a planet Earth. But it's extremely rare, and at a part per billion, that's way too low of a concentration to be of any help in linking together these nucleotides to make DNA and RNA. But here's the real big problem. No one has found a way of taking a sample of random left and right-handed amino acids and selecting out all the ones that are left-handed and getting rid of all the ones that are right-handed so you can actually link together these amino acids. Same problem with ribose. No one has found a way outside of living systems to select out all the left-handed ones and keep the right-handed ones. And that's crucial. You can't make DNA, RNA, and proteins unless homochirality is strictly obeyed. And one Origin of Life research conference I participated in, they tackled the homochirality problem. For 4 days, they brought up the leading biochemists who were researching homochirality. And what they said is, well, we can't make it happen under naturalistic conditions, but we've had some success in making it happen in the laboratory. And this is where they get biochemists with very sophisticated equipment and working with pure chemical samples. And what they do, they found ways so where they destroy the right-handed amino acids more efficiently than the left-handed amino acids. But what they admitted in their lectures, we destroy both. It's just that we destroy the right-handed ones at a greater rate than the left-handed ones. So over time, we wind up with more left-handed ones than right-handed ones. But what they notice is the closer they got to homochirality, the faster the sample disappeared. And so there is a team at MIT that did a lab experiment where they were able to get it all the way to 80% left-handed and 20% right-handed. Well, it still doesn't work for any kind of origin of life scenario. You need 100 and 0. But they said, we made it all the way to 80. And they also said, we actually found some meteorites where they had like 51% left-handed and 49% right-handed. Well, that's pretty close to what you'd expect by chance. And they're basically taking that slight excess and accelerating it under laboratory conditions. But I remember the final lecture came out where they said, you know, the one that had the greatest success was the 80-20. But they said, as we move from 55 to 45 to 60 to 40 to 70 to 30 and finally to 80 and 20, our extrapolation told us we would never get to 100-0. To get to 100-0, we'd have no amino acids left, no matter how big a sample of amino acids we started with. And so the end result was you wouldn't get any at all. And then at the end of the conference, they brought five of the leading homochirality people together. And each of them was given 15 minutes to answer the question, will we ever come up with the building blocks of life? Said, you know, forget the homochirality problem. How much success are we going to be able to do to find the building blocks of life outside of living systems? All five of them ended their 15-minute thing by saying, not only have we no hope of finding the building blocks, we have no hope of finding the building blocks of the building blocks, let alone have any solution to the homochirality problem. But number five here is something that was admitted by people working in homochirality, is that they only got success where they had highly skilled biochemists with a lot of funding and a lot of technological equipment to be able to get the progress they were seeing. And this has now been referred to in the scientific literature as the hand of God dilemma. Namely that when you attend these Origin of Life research conferences, you hear these reports of what they've been able to do in the lab and saying, hey, we can select out left-handed amino acids that we pulled from a sample, and we're actually able to join them together, and we can make tiny pieces of proteins that are as long as 40 amino acids long. Now, they do this by assembling these amino acids on a special kind of clay substrate. But the clay substrate is not something you pull out of your backyard or out of a quarry. They have to buy it from a chemical company. And what they do is they take clays and they chemically transport them under laboratory conditions. So now they got a substrate that actually allows you to assemble these amino acids together. And they frankly admit these clays don't exist outside of these laboratories that manufacture them. And so again, it takes a skilled biochemist just to make the clay substrate where you put these amino acids together. And then what they discovered is you can't put the amino acids together on this clay substrate unless it's governed by skilled biochemists under strict laboratory conditions where they make sure there's no contaminants. And what they're overlooking is the fact in natural conditions, you might get these amino acids linking together, maybe to make two of them that would link together. However, under natural conditions, you've got construction going on at the same time as destruction. You put them together, they fall apart. Under laboratory conditions, you can make sure no destructive chemistry is going on. But again, it takes a highly skilled biochemist to pull that off. And they call it the hand of God dilemma because the biochemist is basically playing the role of an intelligent, powerful creator. And so basically, the biochemist is a substitute for God that did it in the first place. And the fellow who came up with this hand of God dilemma, Clemens Richard, made the comment, you know, we biochemists, we Origin of Life researchers, we don't like the idea that we have to appeal to some divine element to make this all work, but it says we need to at least confess the fact that we're basically a substitute for the mind that did it in the first place. And he actually argued in his paper published in Nature, when we Origin of Life researchers publish our material and talk about the successes we've gotten in the lab, we should carefully calculate how many times we commit the hand of God dilemma, where we substitute ourselves for the mind that must have done it in the first place. And he privately said, I don't think you could come up with a paper where something significant has been achieved, where the hand of God dilemma isn't committed at least a dozen different times. So, and then finally, what we notice with origin of life models is what we see from 3.825 billion years ago, we don't just get LUCA. LUCA is a term that's used in evolutionary biology. It's an acronym that refers to the last universal common ancestor. And it's the idea that physics and chemistry, without any God or mind being involved, came up with an incredibly simple microbe, and from that simple microbe, all life has evolved. The problem is, when we look at the origin of life on planet Earth, we don't see that it's just one very tiny, simple microbe. We see an ecology of microbes. And so we see not only anaerobic microbes, the simplest of the microbes, we actually see aerobic microbes, which means we're actually seeing microbes that are able to use photosynthesis to make sugars, starches, and fats. And these are organisms that have like 4,000 gene products. And so the naturalistic model says the first microbe had maybe 400 or 500 gene products. And we do see those microbes at 3.825 billion years ago, but we also see microbes of 1,500 gene products, 2,000, 3,000, and even more than 4,000 gene products. We see aerobic microbes that are using oxygen. They're actually producing oxygen through photosynthesis. We see anaerobic microbes that are basically getting their energy from methane. We see microbes that produce methane, and also we see sulfate-reducing microbes. It's an entire ecology. Moreover, we see that life back then was not just rare incidences of these microbes. The microbes were abundant on the face of the earth. Now, from a biblical perspective, we would expect that if the Creator is involved, the Creator is going to be aggressive in producing life on planet Earth. And basically, what's been overlooked in the origin of life research community, if you want to bring human beings onto the terrestrial scene, you've got to get started 3.8 billion years ago. And you have to start aggressively, because it's a real challenge to get everything chemically and physically right for human beings in only 3.8 billion years. Now, it's interesting, when I address young Earth creationist audiences, they kind of tremble at the idea of 3.8 billion. They think that's a huge amount of time. But if you're looking at getting from the first microbes up to human beings, it's basically testifying of a God that's rushing things as fast as the physics that he set up would make that possible. And so we'd expect from a biblical perspective that indeed the first life would show up as early as possible in the history of the earth, and that first life would be abundant and diverse in order to jumpstart everything quickly enough to get human beings upon the scene as fast as possible. However, when I've been debating evolutionary biologists, as I've already admitted, they don't want to talk about the origin of life. They want to talk about the history of life. Well, this is the scenario that they have for life's history, that if you go all the way down to the very end, you've got LUCA, the last universal common ancestor, a microbe with only about 500 gene products. It's all by itself, but it evolves, and suddenly you get diverse microbes, and then as time goes on, you wind up with all the life forms we see on the face of the earth today. So there's this progression from very simple, tiny life forms up to more and more diverse life, and life forms that are really big in body size. And the story is this, that life becomes gradually, progressively more complex through common descent, which means a simple organism evolves and gives rise to a more complex organism without any mind being involved. All happens naturalistically, and it happens through four naturalistic mechanisms: natural selection, mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics. Now, when you engage evolutionary biologists or atheists, one term you've got to avoid is Darwinian evolution. In the scientific literature, Darwinian evolution is the idea that there's only one natural mechanism, natural selection. Now, also avoid the term neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism is the idea that life evolves through two mechanisms, natural selection and mutations, where the neo-Darwinists say the mutations actually are responsible for bigger changes than the natural selection. But my experience is evolutionary biologists hate that term as well. We're not neo-Darwinists. We're not Darwinists. We're evolutionary biologists, and we're sophisticated enough to realize we're talking about four mechanisms, not just one or two: natural selection, mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics. Now, the problem is that natural selection mutations are where you get the really most significant changes. Gene exchange, you do see. What gene exchange is happening is when you get two different species of microbes coming together, they can actually trade part of their genome into the other microbe. You see that at the microbial level. You don't see that at the level of megafauna, you know, big animals. Now, you do see with the bigger animals epigenetics. And epigenetics is basically the point that the behavior of adults in one species can actually change the genome of the offspring of that species. And what I find interesting about that is that's actually a biblical principle. The sins of the fathers are passed on to the children to the third and fourth generation. The righteousness of the parents can be passed on to the children to the third and fourth generation. Basically making the point, and this is something that applies to the big advanced animals, the way they behave during their life actually can impact genetics they pass on to their children. And so how you live and behave. And so, for example, if you've got a long history of drug abuse or alcoholism in your family, that actually makes the genes of the children and the grandchildren that come from those individuals to be more likely to have the genetic propensity towards alcoholism or addiction. But I want to emphasize the Bible says that it's not just negative epigenetics that operates, you get positive epigenetics. So, for example, if the parents are generous in the way that they share the resources to help the poor, that actually impacts the genes that are passed on to the next generation. And so we should be sensitive to both. But these are the four mechanisms. Now, evolutionary biologists have searched in vain for a fifth mechanism. And so they're realizing these four mechanisms alone are probably not going to be adequate to explain things, and so they've searched for a fifth. Now, that possibility still exists, but you see in the scientific literature, if there's a fifth mechanism and maybe a sixth and a seventh mechanism, those additional mechanisms will contribute less than 0.5% to the changes we see in life. In other words, we have the four mechanisms that really do everything. It's natural selection, gene exchange, mutations, and epigenetics. We haven't found any other mechanisms, but if they exist, they're basically trivial in what they contribute to the changes. Hey, I see I've gone over my time. I'm going to have to cover the rest of this next week. So I'll stop here, and we'll take questions. And as usual, we'll alternate between people that are here physically and in person, and those that are participating with us virtually online. So it looks like we got an online question.
Minds, Hugh, when you go over time. You're welcome to do it anytime you want. Tom Longo asks, is there any validity to the idea of using, quote, squeezed vacuum to stabilize wormholes, or is this complete science fiction? Can you explain what that means?
Back on. Let me first explain what a wormhole is. I think there was a TV show called Galactica. I forget what the name of the show is. It was a science fiction show I never watched. Battlestar Galactica, and was all based on a wormhole, which allowed you to go from a different space, from one space-time realm to a different space-time realm. But a wormhole is where you got two black holes, and the two black holes get close together, and they touch one another, so that you can go from one space-time realm into the maw of one black hole, go through the other black hole, and come out into a different space-time realm. We can make all the mathematics works, and the squeezing idea is just a technique we can get to mathematically figure out how a wormhole would work. And so I think in Battlestar Galactica, they would literally go from one space-time realm to another by sending their spaceship through the wormhole and coming out the other side. Now, you'll see this in the scientific literature, but it's simply a mathematical possibility. It's a physical impossibility, because in order for the wormhole to work, you got to get the singularity of black hole A to perfectly touch the singularity of black hole B. And what is a singularity? An infinitesimally small volume. So you're trying to join one infinitesimal small volume to another infinitesimal small volume, and you don't have to be very sophisticated in mathematics to realize the probability of that happening is going to be zero. You need something really big in order to get them to be in contact. If they're both infinitesimally small, they're not going to perfectly touch. And then you run into another physical problem. Even if they were to actually perfectly touch one another, they wouldn't be stable. This thing is moving around, and so it's not going to be stable for a long enough period of time that you could travel from one space-time realm into another. And by the way, your spaceship's not going to make it through the wormhole, because as you approach the event horizon of a black hole, what happens is the gravity that you begin to experience as you approach the event horizon of that black hole basically strings out your spaceship or your physical body or a microbe into a long line of fundamental particles. And so if you're a human being approaching the event horizon of a black hole, what you'll experience is your 6-foot-tall body becoming about a 5-mile-long string of particles. And then as you get towards that singularity, the particles get destroyed. And they're not going to reassemble coming out the other end. They're going to remain there, and so you're not going to make it through a wormhole. So, and incidentally, this is application to speculations that people have made that maybe our universe doesn't really have a beginning like the Bible claims. Rather, what you have is a collapsing universe that goes down to a singularity and then becomes an expanding universe from that singularity. But you've got the same problem you got with a wormhole, is that you can't join the geometry of a collapsing universe to the geometry of an expanding universe. It simply doesn't work. And I want to mention Roger Penrose, because he's the one that's most quoted as saying, hey, we can get around the beginning by having a collapsing universe segue into an expanding universe. And he's been explicit saying, yeah, I can make the math work, but it's physically impossible. You're not going to be able to join the geometry of one to the other. He says, keep in mind, I'm a mathematical physicist. I'm paid to speculate about really weird mathematics. This is what I do. And he's not alone. Lots of mathematical physicists engage in that kind of arena. Okay, next question.
Hi, Dr. Ross.
Hello, good to see you again.
Are you kidding? Good to see you. You know, on TV shows, they talk about the multiverse, you know, some of these sci-fi shows. And I've noticed that they kind of present it like it's a result of time travel. You know? So they're able to go back in time and change things. So then there's a parallel universe that it's ridiculous. But that's not my question. My question is about the James Webb Telescope. I keep hearing or seeing things online that state that they found galaxies that are more developed than they should be. And you're nodding, so I think you know what I'm talking about. Can you explain if this makes the age of the universe longer than 13.79 billion years, plus or minus?
Okay, There's so much going on about what the James Webb Space Telescope has discovered and what it's not discovered, that we had reasons to believe on July 13th, that's a Saturday, are going to devote the whole day to what has the James Webb Space Telescope discovered and what does it mean for the Big Bang creation model. I'll be one of the speakers there, but we've literally invited astronomers around the world to participate in that event, including astronomers that have done significant observational work on the James Webb Space Telescope. Roger Windhorst from the University of Arizona is actually going to come and speak at our conference. The good news is it's not just going to be open to people in our scholar community. We're going to open it up to the public. So you can attend in person at Reasons to Believe headquarters, or you can participate virtually. So just watch reasons.org. We'll be announcing that shortly, but it's July 13th. But I've also written some articles at reasons.org under my blog called Today's New Reason to Believe, where I've addressed the most recent James Webb Space Telescope discoveries. And yes, you're right. On the internet, there's all these claims that James Webb is finding galaxies that are too big and too developed to fit the Big Bang creation model. And as I mentioned initially, when that claim was first being made, keep in mind that the biggest and best developed galaxies are the easiest ones to see. So it shouldn't be a shock to you that we're seeing in these initial images from the James Webb Space Telescope galaxies that are exceptionally bright and exceptionally well-developed in the early universe. And I'm old enough to remember when they first discovered quasars, and the same news was coming about. These quasars that we're discovering are too bright and too well-developed to fit the Big Bang model, but those are the easiest ones to detect. And now we found millions of quasars, and we realize those millions of quasars have the statistical distribution that perfectly fits the Big Bang creation model. I'm predicting the same thing will happen with the James Webb Space Telescope. But let me just talk about two discoveries. And both of these are available in an article I've written at reasons.org. Number one, James Webb was finding galaxies in what's called the cosmic dawn. Say, what is that? That's the first billion years of the history of the universe. And during the cosmic dawn is when you get the first galaxies forming. And said, these first galaxies that we're finding have an ultraviolet brightness that's about 10 times greater than what we would expect from a Big Bang creation model. And therefore, they were suggesting maybe we need to not throw out the Big Bang, but we need to radically redesign the Big Bang model to fit these new observations. Then a team of astronomers said, not so fast, because they looked at the claim that the ultraviolet brightness was 10 times too high, and they said, notice what this paper was pointing out is that they were assuming star formation during the first billion years of a galaxy's existence would be steady and constant. But they said, if we look at galaxies from a billion years to 13.8 billion years, after the cosmic creation event, we notice that star formation is not steady, it's not constant, it goes up and down like this. It's stochastic. And so they said, let's just assume that the star formation in the first billion years follows the pattern we see in the rest of the age of the universe. When they did that, they discovered you get ultraviolet luminosities that are about 10 times brighter than if you assume that the star formation is steady and constant. So basically that challenge disappeared, just saying, hey. And they said, further follow-up observations will be able to verify whether or not indeed the star formation is stochastic, but we expect it would be. Okay, second discovery, and this is fairly recent, is they found an early galaxy where they found stars were forming just 300 and 400 million years after the cosmic creation event. You can't get stars to form any earlier than 200 million years. So this was a fairly big galaxy that had early aggressive star formation, But what they found was a cloud in the halo of that galaxy where no stars existed. And that halo was being illuminated by the bright stars in the core of the galaxy, these new formed stars, illuminated sufficiently that they could get a spectrum of the composition of the gas in that clump of gas in the halo. And what did they discover? All it had was hydrogen and helium. There were no elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. And that's one of the major claims of the Big Bang creation model. The universe starts off with just hydrogen, and that during the first 4 minutes after the cosmic creation event, about 25% of the hydrogen gets converted into helium, but only stars make elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. Now, one little caveat, the Big Bang makes a very tiny amount of lithium. So those lithium batteries that you use, they all came from the first 4 minutes of the cosmic creation event. But it's basically a very tiny amount compared to hydrogen and helium. So now we have found a clump of gas which actually shows us what the Big Bang model predicted. Before stars, all you got is hydrogen and helium. It's the first time it's ever been done. It's a breakthrough discovery. But it's basically making the point that James Webb Space Telescope is giving a stronger case for the Big Bang creation model, not a weaker case. But the reason why you got astronomers hoping for a weaker case, they know if it's Big Bang, that's a biblically predicted cosmic creation model. Thousands of years ago, the Bible predicted three, if not four, of the fundamental features we now term the Big Bang creation model.
Thank you, Hugh. Frank McInnes wants to know, when God used Theia to reduce the thickness of the atmosphere on the primordial Earth, could he have cleared the cloud cover entirely at that time so that the sun and the moon would appear on day one?
Question, and what he's referring to is that our solar system began with five rocky planets, not just the four we have today. And so the fifth rocky planet has been called by astronomers Theia, and the Theia had an orbit that was either identical to the Earth's orbit or very close to the Earth's orbit. And what happened about 90 million years after the formation of the solar system, the rocky planet Theia collided with the proto-Earth. Although I think it'd be appropriate to say they merged rather than collided, because that was a time when the proto-Earth had an ocean that was thousands of kilometers deep. And so when Theia collided with the proto-Earth, it basically, the collision was blunted by that very thick ocean. And so what happened was almost all the material of Theia got absorbed into the Earth. The rest of it became a debris cloud around the proto-Earth, and the debris cloud coalesced to make the moon. So that's how the moon came about. It came about as a result of a merger between Theia and the proto-Earth. Now, can you give me the second part of the question? Yeah, you want to know about the atmosphere, okay?
Yeah, you wanted to know if the atmosphere would have cleared, which would have been the explanation for the sun and moon appearing on day one.
Okay. There are two scenarios here. One is that the merger event caused our planet to lose almost all of its water. So instead of having oceans thousands of miles deep, we now have oceans only a few miles deep. And one scenario says that Earth lost the entirety of its atmosphere, but that cometary bombardment replaced the very thick atmosphere that the proto-Earth had with a thin atmosphere. Another model is that, well, the merger event didn't strip away 100% of the Earth's atmosphere, only about 99.9% of the Earth's atmosphere. And again, we get cometary material that basically causes that atmosphere to become about as thick as it has today. Now, whether or not you could actually see the sun, moon, and stars from the surface of the Earth, that's dependent on oxygen in the atmosphere. If you don't have oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere, the atmosphere is hazy, which means you do get light coming through, but you're not going to see through the haze to see the sun, moon, and stars. And it's not until that time when the oxygen content in Earth's atmosphere reaches 8% can creatures on the surface of the Earth actually see the sun, moon, and stars. Actually, that's going to be what I'm going to talk about next week. I'm going to actually talk to you about the oxygen history of the Earth. But for the first couple of billion years, the Earth's atmosphere, in fact, for the first 4 billion years, the atmosphere has so little oxygen within it that the haze remains thick. And so even though the atmosphere is thin, it's hazy enough, you're not going to be able to see through the haze to see what lies beyond the haze. There's these two models. The atmosphere gets completely stripped away and quickly replaced by a thin atmosphere, or almost completely stripped away and then enhanced a little bit by cometary material in the solar system. Go ahead.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the mathematical solution by Roger Penrose for an oscillating universe, I think. Is that what you would call it?
Penrose says it could be an oscillating universe or it might be a one-time thing. His goal was to see if it was possible to conceive of a collapsing universe giving rise to an expanding universe. He says, I can make the math work, but I can't make the physics work.
All right, well then, but a couple of questions arise from that. One is, would that effectively give you a serial multiverse where instead of coexisting universes side by side, you have them one after another, and each one would be a new chance at an entirely different kind of physics? And then, of course, after that, the universe we're presently in, it has been shown to be expanding indefinitely, right, because it's accelerating. So what would that mean for the prior universe?
Yeah, good question. And I developed this in some detail in The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition, how the original oscillating universe, and by the way, this is a Hindu concept, that the universe goes through cycles of birth, death, and rebirth. And when astronomers are coming up with the expanding universe idea, they said, oh, I think we can fit this into a Hindu worldview, where we got a collapsing universe that gives rise to an expanding universe, that gives rise to a collapsing universe, another expanding universe, and how this goes on ad infinitum. The reincarnating universe theory, as it's stated in Hinduism, oscillating universe theory, as it's stated in the physics. But what I explain in The Creator and the Cosmos, if that model really was correct, you would expect that each next stage of expansion would be faster and more aggressive than the previous one. So you can't have this going on ad infinitum. You'll come up with a time when the universe will expand and not collapse. But there have been people saying, well, maybe we've had a few incidences of birth and rebirth, and now we're in one where we're not going to get a collapsing universe. But something else is overlooked. In the Hindu model, you need some kind of mechanism to transition from collapse to expansion. And the problem is the entropy measure of the universe is 100 million tums high to permit that from happening. But then you got people saying, well, okay, maybe we just have one incidence where the universe collapses and expands. We're not going to have these previous episodes of expansion and collapse. That's kind of what Roger Penrose is going after, where he said, I can make the math work, but I can't make the physics work. And then people have been saying, well, maybe we have a multiverse where you got all kinds of universes that were created. And hey, if they're all different, maybe there's a universe where we don't have a national debt. So let's think about that. So, but a critique of the multiverse is we can speculate about it, but we can't prove it. Albert Einstein came up with this more than 80 years ago, where he said, the moment you got observers within a universe, those observers can never detect the possible existence of another universe in a different space-time realm. We're constrained by the space-time surface of this universe. So we can speculate, and from a Christian worldview perspective, we know at least in some way the multiverse must be there, because the Bible tells us that God created a distinct dimensional realm for the angels. So they're outside the universe. Apparently they can come into our universe and they can leave. We humans can't. We're constrained by the physics of the universe. So there is at least one different dimensional realm. And some Christian theologians have said, well, maybe there's several. Maybe there's a different dimensional realm for hell outside of the dimensional realm for the angels and this universe. And who knows how many God has created. The new creation seems to be a distinct one. So yeah, this is not something that's anti-Christian, which is why my colleague, Jeff Zwirink, wrote the book, Who's Afraid of the Multiverse, where he said, if we frame the multiverse in a Christian context, there's no problems with the physics. But if we frame it in an atheistic context, we got huge problems with the physics. It doesn't work from an atheistic perspective. It only works from a Christian perspective. And yeah, I really don't think there's a universe where we don't have any debts and we don't have any crime. But we are told that once God conquers evil once and for all, he'll take us into a realm where there's no pain, no death, and presumably no debt either. So we get to look forward to that as we leave this universe and enter into a new one. And I think, Doug, you asked a question about the multiverse. And pardon me? It got answered. Okay. Yeah. I remember back in the early 1980s speaking on fine-tuning and telling audiences eventually the evidence for fine-tuning that points to the God of the Bible will become so pervasive and so powerful, atheists will have nowhere else to go but to hypothesize there's an infinite number of universes where they're all different from one another, and we just happen to live in the one lucky universe where all the fine-tuning is just right. And it was the atheistic, agnostic, theoretical physicist, Leonard Susskind, who said years ago, we've got to stop using the multiverse. It's a bad argument. It explains everything. An argument that explains everything explains nothing. So the analogy I gave in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos was, if you're going to frame the multiverse like the atheists are framing it, where every universe is different from every other universe, and there's an infinite number of them, keep in mind, infinity times infinity equals infinity. Infinity to the infinity power equals infinity. And so if you're going to appeal to that kind of a multiverse, you're going to have an infinite number of planets just like Earth. And on the infinite number of planets, you're going to have an infinite variety of species of life. And you're going to have an infinite variety of birch trees that peel white pieces of bark. And one of those species will peel perfectly white pieces of bark that are very thin, that are perfectly rectangular, and measure 8.5 by 11 inches. And these pieces of bark will fall on soils with random chemicals in them that'll make markings on these pieces of bark that duplicate all the equations, photographs, tables, paragraphs, equations that you see in every scientific research paper that's ever been published. So those millions of scientific research papers, they didn't come from the minds of scientists, the multiverse did it. So if you appeal to infinity, you can explain anything you want. So you can even explain why you don't even exist if you appeal to an infinity. So whenever you see an atheist appealing to infinity, they're basically saying, I've got nothing. And that's what I told audiences in the 1980s. An appeal to that kind of infinity is basically admission, I've got no evidence. And the one thing I do share is that when you look at the observational experimental evidence for the beginning of the universe created by being beyond space and time, 100% of that evidence supports the Christian declaration of creation and design. There is no observational experimental evidence that counters that conclusion. But it doesn't mean we've got absolute proof that what the Bible tells us about reality is true. We only have a very high probability. You know, I remember addressing an audience of atheist scientists, and I basically told them, I've been married to my wife for 46 years, but even after 46 years of marriage, I don't have absolute proof that she exists. All I got is a very high probability based on lots of experiments and observations. But that evidence gets stronger and stronger with every year that goes by. And Ross, I see your wife is laughing at that. Presumably, the evidence that you exist for her is getting stronger with every year that you're married as husband and wife. I hope that's the case.
Maybe in a couple years she'll actually believe it. Hugh Valderham wants to know, please describe again how evidence of Earth's earliest life could be found on the lunar landscape.
Yeah, I wrote this back in 2007 based on the fact that three astronomers I know calculated how much Earth material is on the surface of the moon. And what's happening is that our planet is being bombarded with asteroids and comets. If the asteroid and comet or the meteorite is big enough, it causes Earth's soil to be exported to interplanetary space, and the moon collects a lot of that exported Earth soil. And they calculated back in 2003 that on the surface of the moon, you got about 20,000 kilograms of Earth soil for every 100 square kilometers of the surface of the moon. And they came up with a follow-up paper saying, we've actually determined that some parts of the moon will have an even heavier load of Earth soil than those 20,000 kilometers. That's an average for the whole lunar surface. But there'll be parts that will have an even heavier load. And in that article, they said, that's the place to find the fossils of Earth's first life, because the moon has virtually no geological activity, and therefore nothing will be there to disturb the nature of those fossils, whereas on Earth, the earliest fossils we can possibly find are about 3.5 billion years old. The geological activity in the first 300 million years of life on Earth has destroyed the fossils of Earth's first life. We got the isotope evidence, we don't have the fossils. And even at 3.5 billion years ago, all we got are fossil parts. We don't have complete fossils. So we can go to the moon and we'll find pristine fossils of Earth's first life. And I remember speaking at NASA Houston about this in 2008. Their scientists were gathered and their astronauts were there. And I said, this needs to be the next mission of NASA. Go to the moon and find the fossils of Earth's first life. And I said, the rationale for this, atheists predict that the fossils of Earth's first life will have only 400 or 500 gene products and will be a tenth of a micron across and will be a single species. Christians predict that the fossils of Earth's first life will be an entire ecological system of microbes. Yes, there'll be microbes only a tenth of a micron across, but you'll have some that'll be 1 and 2 microns across. And you'll have some with 500 gene products, but some with 4,000 gene products and everywhere in between. I said, NASA has the opportunity to go to the moon and prove who got it right, the atheists or the theists. And last time I checked, atheists and theists made up 100% of the U.S. taxpayer base. So everybody should be excited about seeing this funded. But the way things are going now, I wouldn't be surprised if the Chinese are the first to find the fossils of Earth's life on the moon. They seem quite committed to do that. So, and by the way, we're not in the 1970s anymore. We don't have to send astronauts. This can all be done with machines at relatively low cost, which should make all you taxpayers excited. Go ahead.
I was wondering, in your lifetime, how many atheist scientists or physicists changed their mind that you know and came to believe like you did?
Okay. How many atheist scientists I've seen go from atheism to Christianity during my life? Well, I've seen it happen where I was personally engaged with them. I've also seen it happen with people that I've not been personally engaged with. The ones that I know of for a fact would number in the dozens. But I recall showing up at Caltech, brand new, just with my PhD. And they said, we got a lot of postdocs here at Caltech. We've given you a big office, but you got to share it with another postdoc. And the postdoc I was sharing it with was Ian Lockhart from Australia. Very committed atheist. But he saw a Bible on, he had to go through my office to get to his office. And so he saw a Bible on my desk and he said, "You're not one of those Bible thumping Christians, are you?" And I said, "Well, this Bible's too small to thump anybody with it. And that's not how I use it." But every day he would ask me a question about Christianity or the Bible, but every day he would ridicule everything I said with the other astronomers. This went on for a year and a half, and then a day came by when he talked to all those astronomers in the coffee room and said, "I no longer can ridicule the Bible or Hugh Ross because last night I gave my life to Jesus Christ." So, and I saw another physicist at Caltech do the same thing. And one thing I've been sharing with you here in the paradoxes class, when you're talking a PhD level scientist who has no Christian background and has not really looked at the Bible, it typically takes at least 2 years for them to do the study that they need to do to be able to transition from atheism to Christianity. So one reason why I can only tell you of a few dozen is that there is this long process, and so it takes time. I mean, another one I know of at Caltech, very famous astronomer, probably the most famous astronomer of the 20th century, Alan Sandage. He went from atheism to Christianity, but for him it was a 35-year journey of studying the Bible, studying other religions, and he actually showed up here at this church, and he signed one of the registration cards. And at that time, I was a minister of evangelism. I said, "This can't be the real Alan Sandage." I mean, I knew who he was, and just the kind of care. I said, "There's no way this guy's given his life to Christ." But I said, "I'm going to visit him." So I went to his home with a brand new Christian, and he had us come in, and I knew right away, this guy looks different. He's gracious. I never knew Alan as a gracious individual. But he was gracious, had to sit down, wanted nobody wanted anything to drink. And then he said, "You know, I've been on a journey trying to find what is true. It took me 35 years, then I finally became convinced about the Bible." But he says, "I've been checking out churches." And he said, "I went through the phone book and came up with a list of 66 churches within 15 miles of my home. And I went to all those churches. I never went in. I just parked my car and watched what was going on. I wanted to know if people were going into the church with a Bible in their hand, at least a few of them, and whether some of them had notebooks. And I wanted to know if they came out looking happier than when they walked in." And so on that basis, I reduced it to 6 churches. And then I visited each of those 6 churches for 6 consecutive Sundays and signed everything I could find, registration cards, you know, a welcome book, whatever they had. I wanted to see if they cared enough about me that they would follow up. And I said, "Well, what happened?" He says, "Well, all 6 churches followed me up. You're the last church on my list." And then I asked them 2 questions. I said, "Well, what 2 questions did you ask?" Question number 1, "Do you believe the Bible is the inspired and inerrant word of God from cover to cover, including the table of contents?" And I said, "Well, what happened?" He says, "All 6 churches said, yes, we believe that." He says, "The second question is, how old do you think the universe is?" And so he asked me personally, "How old do you think it is?" And I said, "Well, I'm from the University of Toronto, and I'm well aware of the debate between you and Sidney Vandenberg. I took a course from Sidney Vandenberg, and I know he's been talking about how the universe is 10 billion years old. You've been talking about it being 16 to 18. So I know I'm being put on the spot here. Am I going to go with Sidney Vandenberg, or am I going to go with you?" But he says, "Even when I was at the University of Toronto, I leaned more towards your age than I did to Sidney Vandenberg's age." And he says, "That's fine with me. Anything within a factor or 2 I can handle. I just can't handle this 10,000 year stuff." And then he put me on the spot and says, "Well, I can see you believing this. What about the other pastors at Sierra Madre Congregational Church? Do they all agree with you?" And I says, "Well, come back again. Find out for yourself." So he attended here for a number of years. His 2 sons he led to the Lord. Never led his wife to the Lord. And he told me personally, that was, said, My wife was religious when I married her. I convinced her to be an atheist. Now that I'm a Christian, I can't get her from atheism to Christianity. But both of his sons committed their lives to Jesus Christ, and both of them were quite active here in the church for a number of years. In fact, the wife of one of them led the children's ministry here for a number of years. So that's two stories. I could give you more, but let's get on with the rest of the questions.
Hugh, if we were in another universe, we wouldn't be out of time. But in this one, we are. Would you please close us in prayer?
Good comment, because when we go to the new creation, we're never going to be out of time, because we're not going to be constrained to linear time in the new creation. Think about that as you leave today. Father in heaven, we do acknowledge that you're a big, big God. Yes, you've created this universe for us to live in and to serve and please you, but you've got other realms. The new creation that you've promised for us, once evil is eradicated totally, we'll be able to enter that realm. Father in heaven, as we think about where we're headed, I pray, Father, you would give us opportunities, just like the opportunities I had to see atheists come to faith in Christ, Lord. May you give each one of us here an opportunity to share with people, because the new creation's a big place. And Lord, we know you want it to be full. So help us to invite people to your banquet table in the new creation. Help us to do that with compassion, love, and gentleness and respect, and the wisdom that you grant us. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.